They send Williams in motion from the one. The flip to Williams. Oh. Around the left end. Woo. Touchdown! Touchdown, Isaiah Williams! Touchdown, Illinois!
I just got done telling the guys we can't have this season be the same movie because this game looked like the same movie today. I don't know what we're doing, fielding the punt inside the one and then trying to throw it out of the end zone. Missing a couple extra points certainly didn't help. Connor, I got all the faith in him in the world. He's been the only all-conference player we've had since I've been here, and I haven't seen that from him. So probably the biggest play in the game was the 30 yards of penalties on the interception when we were up a score and going to get the ball back. Those things just change games. And then the fumble at the end of the half. And second half felt like every time we got something started on offense, we got a holding or a offensive pass interference or a bad snap. I haven't seen any of those all camp. So it looked like the same movie today. We can't let it be that way. I feel bad for them because they put in so much hard work. We put a lot on this game, and they'll bounce back. But you know, I know how much better our team is right now than what we've been. Didn't always look like it today.
Well, you heard him right there. Scott Frost, head coach of Nebraska Cornhuskers in his fourth season. And it was not a good start to his fourth season. Guy that's on the hot seat, and he said, new season, same movie. And, yeah, it's same, you know, same book, same chapter, new book, different, same, new book, same chapter. I mean, you can use all kinds of analogies. I heard that on the Husker broadcast when I was driving over the weekend as well, listening to the broadcast. And, by the way, Greg Sharp does a wonderful job play-by-play. He is just so smooth. He's not over the top. He's not way too down, even though they're struggling right now. I mean, he just has the right tenor, I think, and he does a wonderful job with play-by-play, and Davidson's a nice sidekick for him as a color analyst, but not a lot to cheer about if you're a Husker fan. We're going to break this down a little bit and try to figure out what Nebraska can do to change things around, because it does seem like it's the same thing year in and year out, and there are a lot of people calling for Scott Frost to be done, and there are a lot of Husker fans that are now, honestly, just apathy has set in. It's like, well, we just suck. I mean, seriously, to be just blunt with you, that's what people are telling me, is that we're just no any good. We don't got the athletes. We don't recruit. We don't have good coaching staff. We got a quarterback turns the ball over. We got guys that make mental mistakes, and that comes down to either coaching or kids not listening to coaching, which is still coaching because coaches got to get through the kids. So we'll talk more about that coming up in a little bit. Plus, Salvador Perez, man, tell you what, people across the country should take notice. The only problem is he's on a losing team. That's going to hurt. But Salvador Perez is putting up numbers that are worthy of being an MVP. If Shohei Ohtani is worthy of being an MVP on a team that's got a losing record, why shouldn't Salvador Perez? So we'll discuss that a little bit. And the Chiefs will get ready for their season opener September 12th. They had a preseason finale on Friday. They look pretty good, especially the first stringers. And we'll discuss that. And John Betts, the Kansas pregame, will join us to preview 8-man Division 2 and 8-man Division 1 around 9:40, 9:45 here this morning. But we turned over to Dusty first, where there was volleyball here recently to kick off the season. And the Boyette Lady Trojans with a huge 5-set victory. And then the rankings came out, and it's like you might want to revise the rankings right away after that happened. So great win for Coach Paul and her Lady Trojans in a very exciting match down at Hayes at TMP that you could have seen on live video streaming. You can still go back and watch it. It's archived. Just hit the on-demand tab. Once you get to the – go to nckssports.com, click on the Trojan channel, hit the on-demand tab, and you can access the archive of that. There is an access fee for the archive, and you can get a month's access to any of the archives for a small fee, and then there's a yearly discounted fee, and it's always free when you want to stream live. I mean, the sponsors make it free when you want to watch it live, but if it's an archive you want to go back, or if you want to download a copy of it and have it sent to your email, there are access fees for that. But I tell you, it was a pretty exciting match for Beloit.
Yeah, 5-set win over TMP Marion, as you said, down there in Hayes. And I'll just hit rankings real quick because TMP did start the season at number 3 there in Class 3A.
And Beloit was down 14-12 in the fifth set. They were facing 2 match points, and they scored 4 straight to win it in the fifth set. They were down 14-12, 2 match points against them. So that's how close they were to losing that match.
Yeah.
So it should be pointed out.
It's a nice, exciting way to start the season, right? Get them all, you know, pumped up and maybe could springboard this group to a really good season if they can build off of that momentum. But again, TMP was number 3 to start, and Beloit not ranked, but as you said, that could change here on the next rankings when they come out next week. So we'll keep an eye on that in Class 3A. And then Phillipsburg from the Mid-Continent League also starts the season at number 6 in the 3A rankings from the Kansas Volleyball Association. Smith Center starts number two in those rankings in Class 2A. They're behind the defending state champs, Heritage Christian out of Olathe. Those are the two teams that finished 1-2 last year at the state tournament in Class 2A. So clearly Smith Center has everybody back from last year's team. Should be a very good squad this year, and they'll open their season coming up tomorrow. Also in Class 1A, Division 1, Thunder Ridge opened the season at number 10, and St. John's Tipton opened the season at number 10 in 1A Division 2. And both of those teams picked up wins on Friday to open their season. Thunder Ridge got a sweep of both Chase and Natoma at the Natoma Triangular on Friday, and then Chase beat Natoma in three in the other match there. And then St. John's Tipton won in five sets over Osborne in the Northern Plains League opener in Osborne on Friday as well. So great start to the season for both of those teams that are ranked in 1A Division 1 and 1A Division 2. So you can find the full scores of all those matches at ncksports.com. Full schedules for all your favorite sports teams for the fall sports season are also posted at ncksports.com. And you can find the full Kansas Volleyball Association rankings at the website as well. So, yeah, fall sports season underway. More volleyball coming up tomorrow for a lot of the area teams that will actually open their seasons coming up tomorrow. And then Thursday, cross country will open for most of the area teams. And then Friday, area teams will start high school football. So a lot of activity coming up this week. We'll have our first locker room chats Wednesday and Thursday with high school football coaches as well. So stay tuned for all of our schedule all the time here at Katy Country 94 and katycountry94.com.
All right. Well, I tell you, we talked about this on Friday. You and I both picked Illinois to beat Nebraska. I had this very strong feeling Nebraska was going to lose. And being a Husker fan right now has to be maddening. It has to be maddening because it's not like the Huskers go out and get rolled. They don't. They rarely get rolled. They're in games. They just shoot themselves in the foot. It's like they're Wile E. Coyote. They catch the Roadrunner, but then don't know what to do with the Roadrunner and then lose the Roadrunner, and the Roadrunner always wins. That's how I see Nebraska football. They're the Wile E. Coyote. They're Yosemite Sam. They play well enough to be close. They play well enough that after the game, you watch the game and you say, dude, they should have won. And after the game, you're like, but they lost, and they lost because they beat themselves. And That's what Nebraska football is all about now. It's how not to beat yourself. And until they stop beating themselves, they're going to have a bad year. And we were looking at the schedule. I've had a few Husker fans actually had the audacity, and I say audacity, to say they're going to go 8-4 this year. And I'm like, what do you got to go off of that? You're not the Huskers from the 90s. You're not going to go 8-4. And if you're going to go 8-4, you sure as heck better beat Illinois. First game under a new head coach, new system, that's a time to catch him. Oh, yeah, starting quarterback you knock out in the first quarter. Now you got a backup quarterback who, by the way, used to be the quarterback at Rutgers who threw three interceptions against KU a couple years back and lost to KU. And this guy torched Nebraska. 12 of 15. What was it, touchdown or two? I mean, you just sitting here, I'm like, it couldn't have been a worse beginning to the season for Scott Frost as a head coach than this game. I mean, Arthur Sitkowski, 12 of 15, 124 yards, two touchdowns, a backup, a transfer from Rutgers. You knock out the starter and you still lose. You give up 167 yards rushing, which isn't horrendous. Nebraska, 160 yards rushing, but only 160s from Adrian Martinez and 75 of the 160s on one run. Adrian Martinez, 16 of 32 for 232, one touchdown, no interception, sacked five times. I got all kinds of questions. So here we go. But let's go through some of the major mistakes. This is how you lose. Let's see, I hear this too. Well, we were good enough to win. We just beat ourselves. When we keep doing that over and over, you're a bad team.
You're not good enough to win if you keep beating yourselves.
Right. It could happen once, but if it happens over and over, listen, it's simple. When you go to Illinois and you lose a game like that, and you beat yourself with all these mistakes, bad teams do that. Yeah, I hear this one. Nebraska's not that far away, according to some people. But they're showing no signs of getting over the hump. Good teams find a way to win that game. Bad teams find a way to lose. That's exactly what Nebraska did. They flat out found ways to lose. And it all started with one of the simplest things in punt returning that you're taught at a, you're taught this in junior high and high school. It's pretty simple. When you return a punt, it depends on the coaching staff, but usually they'll tell you stand on the 10. And if the ball is over your head, you just don't do anything. Now, in the NFL, it's more of the 5. It's becoming more of the 5 because they want the return. So you stand on the 5. If it's a deep kick, you go back to the 5. If it's over your head, you just let it go. There's no point in catching it, returning it. Don't take a fair catch because let it bounce in the end zone. What's the difference between the 5 and the 2? It's not a major difference. It's a little bit, but not major. So you're taught that. On the broadcast, I was listening on the radio broadcast and said, you get it. Reggie Bush said it during the TV at halftime because Reggie Bush returned kicks all the time for USC. Mm-hmm. He said, we were taught you stand on the 9. Okay, 9 or 10, whichever way you want to go. You stand on the yard line. And if the ball goes over your head, you stay away from it. You don't do anything. What is Taylor Cam Britt doing? He goes back and catches the ball at the 1, then realizes, oh, no. And then it's an episode of the Follies, the Husker Follies. And he tries to throw the ball forward, which if that would have been caught in play, would have been even worse. It's like, dude, what are you doing? I don't want to put it all on one kid, but that's what started the avalanche of mistakes. And it might have happened anyway without that, but what are you doing? So he gets tackled in the end zone. It's a safety. So Nebraska hands Illinois 2 points. So then Nebraska bounces back, right? They come back. They score a touchdown. They miss the extra point. Okay, no big deal. 6-2. Here we go. Nebraska's got the ball. What was it? Inside the 10. Little play action. Wide open receiver. Martinez misses him.
2 on that drive there inside the 20. Just terrible throws.
Terrible throws. For an experienced quarterback.
Yeah.
And he misses both, and Nebraska has to settle for a field goal. They're up 9-2 when they should have been up 14-0.
Yeah.
I mean, it should have been 14-0 Nebraska dominating. But you hand them 2 points. You refuse to take 4 points for a touchdown pass because you can't complete it. And instead of being up 14-0, it's 9-2. And we're just getting started with the mistakes by Nebraska. So now you're up 9-2. So things are still all right. Your defense comes up with an interception. Woohoo! Nebraska's got the ball. They're up 9-2. Momentum's on their side. Oh, wave it off. Personal foul. Roughing the passer. Plus a taunting. 30 yards in penalties. And now Illinois is in business.
Yeah.
So Illinois goes down and scores. If that wasn't bad enough, it's 9-9. Under a minute to play. Nebraska's trying to do something offensively. Adrian Martinez steps up in the pocket, being pressured, holds the ball out like a loaf of bread, which has been a major problem for him his entire career. He has 36 turnovers as a starting quarterback. Bad interceptions. And then, of course, the fumbles are the ones you really just like, seriously, you got to hold on to the ball, man. And he fumbles it, and it's picked up and returned for a touchdown. And it's 16-9. And then Nebraska decides to snap it inside their own, 25? With 1 second left before half. I'm like, what good is going to happen here? That could have been a disaster, too. So they're going in the locker room down 16-9, and they should be up 14-0. Seriously, 14-0. They handed Illinois 14-7 at worst. 14-7 at worst should have been the score. Instead, they're down 16-9, and you know they're human. And what's going through the kids' heads? Here we go again. Here we go again. I'm sure the coach is thinking about it. Okay, we got to right the ship. How are we going to do this? And then the second half, your defense. Nebraska's defense actually played pretty well first half. Second half, Illinois comes out. 7.5-minute drive. 14 plays, 75 yards, score a touchdown. Take half of the third quarter off the clock. Perfect. What Brett Bielema, who's the new head coach of Illinois, if you didn't know, that's exactly what he wants. Shortens the game. Defense can't get off the field. Then the offense, down 23-9, you got to do something. 3-and-out. 3-and-out, have a holding penalty. Now you're kicking for your own end zone. Illinois gets the ball at your own 40, at the Nebraska 47. They go in and score again. That was a touchdown you just heard. Now it's 30-9. Now, to Nebraska's credit, they battle back. They got the 75-yard touchdown run by Martinez. 30-16 and 30-22. Missing another extra point, which could have been huge had they got the ball back, but they didn't. And Nebraska loses 30-22. And you heard Scott Frost talk about the mistakes. It's a different season, but it's the same movie. He's right. He's absolutely right. I will say this about Scott Frost. I know a lot of people take a lot of shots at Scott Frost. One thing I do appreciate about Scott Frost is he's blunt. I appreciate Scott Frost being just very candid, and he will say what he feels. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that from people. Because the people that rip Scott Frost when he says something that they don't think is the right thing to say are the same people get tired of the, oh, he says the same thing but never tells us anything of substance. Well, which way is it? Okay, Scott Frost to me is refreshing in regards to what he says after the game. He's very blunt. He's like, you know, come on, we can't be filling the punt at the one. What are we doing? You know, what are we doing? We can't get 30 yards of penalties when we have interception, and then we have the ball up 7 with momentum. We can't do that. I mean, he specifically points them out. He doesn't call out a player and throw him under the bus specifically by name, but you definitely know who he's talking about.
Yeah.
And those kids already know it. So they're not going to get mad because he mentioned in the press game or post-game conference because they know they messed up. So, you know, I had somebody say, well, quarterback play is terrible. Okay, quarterback play isn't good. It wasn't good. I agree. I don't think they have the greatest weapons around Adrian Martinez either. And that comes back to recruiting. Adrian Martinez missed a couple of wide-open throws that should have been touchdowns, as we just alluded to. He held the ball loosely. That's something he's got to do a better job of, is not have the turnovers. That would have resulted in a touchdown. But you can't put all this on Adrian Martinez. You can't put it on just the quarterback. You got to put this on kids making boneheaded mistakes. And Taylor Cam Britt isn't a freshman. He's experienced. So the mistakes Nebraska have are coming from some of their veteran players or older players, more experienced players. And here's the next question I have. What's the identity of Nebraska football offensively? Like, what is their identity? What are they good at? Like, I heard this in the post game by one of the sideline reporter and on the radio. And I was like, dude, he's so on. He goes, my biggest question and the thing that I'm almost a little bit more worried about than anything, he goes, I have no idea what the identity of this football team is. He said, we ran for 160 yards, but 111 of them from Adrian, and 5 of those were on pass plays that weren't supposed to be runs, and 75 yards on one run. If you take away the 75 yards, all they had was 85 yards rushing. Take away Martinez, and your running backs averaged 2 yards a carry, and yeah, it's not good. So if they're not a good passing team, which they aren't, then you better be a good running team. Well, what's your identity? Are you going to play smash-mouth football? Are you going to? Is your offensive line good enough to play physical football? I don't know what their identity is. I have no clue. And the other thing, too, is defensively, even though their defense wasn't bad the first half, the defense did give up 167 yards rushing, and the top running backs for Illinois averaged 5 yards or 4.5 yards a carry. And Illinois is not the greatest rushing team of all time. And then getting back to Nebraska on offense, you know what Illinois' rush defense was ranked last year? 116th. If Nebraska can't run against Illinois, how are they going to run against Ohio State, Michigan, Penn State, Michigan State? How are they going to run against Oklahoma? I mean, you do. I mean, granted, it's just one game. Here's the thing. People are going to freak out. Husker fans are freaking out already, or they've just been, like, already resigned to say we stink. That's how my friends have said it. My one friend said, Frost is done. It's over. It's just a matter of time. I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. But the biggest thing I took out of this game was Scott Frost is dead man walking in regards to his coaching at Nebraska. That's what I took out of it. To me, this was a must win. But not only that, if he lost, at least show some kind of improvement. They made the same mistakes. They made the same mental mistakes. And he even knows it. And he's resigned to saying it afterwards. And if you keep making the same mistakes over and over, especially on special teams, which has been a problem for Nebraska since Frost has been there, if you're an athletic director, Trev Alberts, who is a guy that did not hire Scott Frost, you got to be sitting there going, I don't see any improvement whatsoever in this first game. We had we supposedly have this better team. Scott Frost is the best team he's had since he's been there. And, you know, we cheated and had extra practices last year. That didn't help us. We're doing all this, focus on special teams. That doesn't seem to help. We're making brain cramp decisions, and granted, it was just one game, but this doesn't show me any improvement from the previous few years. There's nothing to take away from this game where it says Nebraska's an improved team. There is nothing out of this game to say Nebraska's an improved team. Illinois, I don't think, is going to be that good, personally. I don't, especially with a backup quarterback, because I think their starter is probably going to be done for the year. Broken collarbone, shoulder, dislocated shoulder. He's going to be out for a while. They're not great even with him. So this is a game that you're supposed to win. And granted, it's week one and it's Big Ten play instead of a week non-con to kick off the season, but you're still supposed to win. It's at Illinois. You're still supposed to win. Or are you? Are you supposed to win? If you're Nebraska, nowadays there's no gimme whatsoever.
You lost by 18 to this team at home last year, so are you supposed
to win? You were down by 21
yeah.
in this game, although exactly. You really handed most of it to him. I agree with my buddy up in Omaha. He said, Frost is done. That's all he said in the text. He didn't elaborate, and he didn't have to. He said, Frost is done. And I pretty much feel the same way. The only thing that's going to save Scott Frost is they got to start winning games and win them quickly. They got Fordham coming up, then Buffalo, which those games aren't going to mean anything unless they lose them because they're supposed to win them. So Nebraska should be 2-1. They better be 2-1 going into Norman, Oklahoma against the Oklahoma Sooners. And you wonder why TV networks didn't want to make it primetime? Here's your answer. It's 11 a.m. There's a reason. Not against Oklahoma. It's against Nebraska. It's the state of their football program. Listen, I know Husker fans are listening, and they're probably like, they might agree with most of what I say. They might be frustrated. They might have already checked out. And I will say, technically, they played one game. There's 11 more to go. I mean, Nebraska, they could right the ship. Adrian Martinez suddenly figures something out. They start running the ball, so it takes pressure off Adrian Martinez. The kicker stops missing extra points. They stop filling the ball inside their own one on a punt. Guys get, you know, don't have an interception negated. There's no scoop fumble for a touchdown. You erase the mistakes. Okay, then Nebraska can improve. And Nebraska then will have a good season. But there's nothing in the tenure at Scott Frost's tenure at Nebraska, which is now the fourth year in counting, to show Nebraska's going to turn the corner because they make those same mistakes. This isn't year one. This is year four. And here's an amazing number. Scott Frost is now 12-21 at Nebraska. By comparison, three different coaches in Nebraska school history have won 12 games in a season. Frank Solich, who was fired after 1-9, Tom Osborne, and Bob Devaney. Now, granted, there's not a lot of colleges that can say, yeah, we've had three coaches win 12 games in a season, in fairness, to Scott Frost.
Yeah.
And when Scott Frost was hired, I'm like, you know, I thought it was a great hire. It was a no-brainer hire. There was nobody in Huskerville saying we shouldn't hire Scott Frost. Nobody.
No.
He was a hot commodity, undefeated Central Florida. Kids loved him, played for him, comes to Nebraska. He's the chosen one. He comes back. He's going to bring back what he knows what Nebraska's about, this and that. And it just has not worked. Now, maybe they can – I played the song, the band Perry Comeback Kid, after my trivia question today, which was how many games has Scott Frost won as a coach in Nebraska. And gave away a free Blizzard for that. And the Comeback Kid thing is, you know, maybe brokenhearted, whatever, but we're the Comeback Kids. That's what Nebraska's got to be now. They got to be the Comeback Kids. They've got to be a team that's going to sit here. As Cam Jurgens said, offensive lineman in Nebraska after the game, he goes, we can talk all we want, but until we make bleep happen, it don't matter. He's right.
Yeah.
He's absolutely right. Scott Frost can say all the right things in press conferences. They can look great at practice, which Frost said, we didn't do any of this type of stuff when we've been practicing. Well, okay, but then when all of a sudden the lights are on and it's big time, and you can't even beat Illinois on the road, that's not a good sign, especially the way you lost this game. So it's a combination. It's the quarterback play was not good, but that's not the main reason they lost, in my opinion. It was all the other stuff. All the other stuff combined. And then I don't know. You can argue that they're not well coached. They keep making the same mistakes over and over. Keep shooting themselves in the foot. You can argue they're not well coached. You can sit here and blame the players for not making the right decisions, but isn't that the coach's job to help them mature and make the right decisions on the football field? Isn't that part of coaching? It appears to be a mess right now. I think the crazy thing is if Nebraska somehow loses one of the next two games against Fordham or Buffalo at home, I think you're going to see the sellout streak end. I know there are a lot of boosters trying to keep it alive and spend a lot of money, but I think at some point you just got – that's going to be the ultimate nail in the coffin for Scott Frost is when that sellout streak ends, which I don't know if it will this year because people couldn't attend last year, so maybe the people are going to go no matter what because it's football and an event and tailgating. So he may get bailed out from that standpoint, but there are no signs pointing in the right direction right now for Nebraska. None.
No. I did. When Adrian Martinez is taking the field as the starting quarterback after all these things that have gone on, and then he has a game like that, it's I mean, that's where it starts for me, right? I mean, obviously, it starts with Scott Frost, but when you have a quarterback that's turned the ball over as many times as you said,
36
and
times,
and he's your guy, and
which
then he goes
year,
out
he
and
was
plays
sharing
like that.
Time on McCaffrey. McCaffrey transferred out. Now Martinez is the guy by default almost.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, what he has 200 some passing yards, but he's 50% passing, misses two easy scores, right?
Yep. Runs on one, I mean, his numbers don't look bad. He ran for 111.
Yeah, had 75 on one play, right? And so you broke free, had a good run. Other than that, you didn't run for very many yards. You know, you didn't have a great game on the ground either. You had a great run,
right?
But you didn't have a great game on. So his numbers look all right.
Mm-hmm.
One fumble,
which was a touchdown the other way.
Yeah, and it ended up at a touchdown. And so there's so many numbers that look okay if you would just look at it,
if you didn't watch the game.
Mm-hmm. But when you watched the game and understood how many things happened because he didn't do or perform like he could as a veteran quarterback, as you would expect and want from a veteran quarterback. That's where it starts for me on that offense.
I agree with you.
You've got to do some good things and maybe take a role that, I mean, you're going to have somebody step up and do things, and he's the guy I think that needs to do that.
I agree with you, but and I have a different take if this is a professional quarterback, but this is a college quarterback, and I would give you a bit of a different take. Adrian Martinez, I agree with you. He has to play better. I mean, he had a couple throws, obviously, that were big, and if he doesn't, you know, hold the ball like a loaf of bread, protect it, he was getting hit, and he was already being hit before, and he somehow still didn't tuck it in. I don't know why. That's on him, no doubt. But in fairness, Adrian Martinez, here's what the other four running backs did in this game. 12 carries, 34 yards, 4 for 11, 3 for 10, 2 for 9. Dude, mm-hmm. They averaged 2 yards a carry with their running backs, yeah. 2.5 yards. I mean, in fairness to Adrian Martinez, he can't be running for his life all the time. And yeah. In fairness to Adrian Martinez, he shouldn't have to make every single play on offense with his arm and his legs. I mean, he's got to have some help, and that means they've got to be able to, one, the coaches call better plays perhaps, actually stick to the running game perhaps, or find something else that works. But the offensive line's got to do a better job. The running backs got to do a better job. And obviously, special teams was atrocious. You can sit here and blame Adrian Martinez, and I understand that's where it starts with you, for you. And I agree.
I'm not putting it all on him. I know,
but I just want to, in fairness to Adrian Martinez, he does need some help.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, he can't be the one telling Taylor Cam Britt not to, you know, don't fumble at the one.
Absolutely.
That's on him.
Yeah.
You know, the kicker missing 2 extra points is on them. The guy that gets the interception and then the other guy gets the personal foul, then the gets the interception, that's not on Adrian Martinez, all right? Adrian Martinez, what's on him is the turnover, obviously. It's the missed passes on the opportunities. Adrian Martinez is part of the problem. He's not the only problem.
No.
And I get that you say it starts with him because quarterback play is so paramount in football now because you do pass it more than you run it. It is paramount to have a really good quarterback. There's no doubt about it. But in fairness, Adrian Martinez, he needs a little bit of help. He got no help. He got no help in the run game whatsoever. And he got sacked 5 times, by the way. And also, I don't know if he had receivers. When I was watching the game, I didn't see receivers wide open left and right either. I'm not going to sit here and say they got a lot of separation.
Yeah.
They don't have the greatest receiving core either.
No.
And that goes back to then putting it on the coaches. For me, it starts with the coaches.
Well, absolutely.
I don't start with Adrian Martinez.
No, and I'm not
start
starting with,
coaches with
I'm starting with coaches, but as far as players on the field.
Well, I'm talking with coaches.
You see how it happens.
It goes to recruiting. It goes to recruiting.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
You should have somebody. Adrian Martinez was a Heisman Trophy caliber guy after his first year. He had a really good first year, and people were talking about it as a Heisman hopeful as a sophomore. He's regressed that much. And it's like, how? How has that happened? I mean, Scott Frost comes in here, it's Adrian Martinez. It's like, well, that's not a bad deal, you know? You sit here and you're like, Adrian Martinez could be a star. Their recruiting for 2022 right now is last in the Big Ten, according to rankings. It's not looking like it's going to get any better, which is another problem for Scott Frost moving forward to keep his job. So it's a collective thing, no doubt. And I hear you. It starts with your quarterback in regards to the guys on the field. I get that. I do get that. But I do understand that I watched the game too, and then I listened to the second half. I mean, there was no run game. The run game was Aaron Martinez running on a pass play.
Yeah.
That was the run game. And you take away a 75-yard run, there wasn't really much of a run game. And once again, I go back to, what's the identity? They can't be, let's have Adrian throw it 30 to 40 to 50 times a game. They're not going to win that way.
No.
They're going to have to run the ball, and it's going to have to be other guys besides Adrian Martinez. And clearly against a team that's not 116th against the run last year, Nebraska couldn't do much. That doesn't bode well for anything after the next 2 weeks. Once you get into Oklahoma and Norman and then Big Ten play the rest of the year, they're going to face a lot better teams than Illinois defensively. So that's why I have a hard time being positive about going forward with Nebraska. And for Nebraska fans, it's hard for them to be positive because we've got a quarterback that continues to, you know, make mistakes or, you know, not make the passes he needs to make. He fumbles a ball return for a touchdown because he's loose with the ball. That's been a problem and a knock on him for the very beginning, even when he was super talented as a freshman. But you also got to look around and go, what about these athletes? Can they play legitimately against the big boys in the Big Ten? I would argue they maybe can't because they do not have a lot of weapons around Adrian Martinez. They don't.
No.
And defensively, they actually played pretty well for the first half. And then when they really need their defense, coming fresh out of the locker room, they gave up a 14-play, 75-yard drive that took almost 8 minutes off the clock. And that part isn't Adrian Martinez's fault either.
No, no.
So, and by the way, Illinois made a major adjustment at halftime, and that's a big reason why they had more success running the ball in the second half. Nebraska, I don't know what adjustments they fully made, and once again, that goes back to who? Coaching staff.
Exactly.
And thus, Scott Frost catches the heat. I don't know, man. I don't see how Nebraska – we said it before the game Friday. 4-8. After losing Illinois, I can't see anything better than 4 or 5 wins. And that's not bowl eligible, and that's probably means Scott Frost is done. And according to my buddy, who's a major Husker fan that follows it closely, he already said he's done, and we're one game into the season. So is that an overreaction? Is it a knee-jerk reaction? Or is it on point?
I think it's a guy that knows his team and what their schedule is.
I think so, too.
I don't think smart it's guy. Over, under anything. I think it's the right reaction. I think it's what Nebraska and where they are right now.
That's where they are right now.
That's just what it is right now. I mean, you're not skirting around it. I mean.
No. Man. Just a collage. I mean, could there have been a worse season opener for a guy on a hot seat?
I don't think so.
Because not only did they lose, it was the way they lost.
Yeah. I mean, there's probably been season openers that have been as bad, but
right.
Not worse. Based on his situation.
Based on what was on the line and everything. Yeah. I don't know. I'm just sitting here shaking my head after that one. Like, that's about as worse as you could draw up. Whew. All right. So hopefully for Husker fans, the Huskers can be the comeback kids, as the band Perry sings about. The Royals, they lost to Seattle Mariners 4-3 yesterday. The Royals won 3 out of 4 in Seattle. So that's, you know, you think about their road trip. It's pretty impressive. They went 7-3. They played good teams. And Salvador Perez is flat out just absolutely annihilating the baseball.
Bob Oliver and right on cue. Salvador Perez hits it off the facing of the upper deck. So make it 8 home runs and 15 RBIs on this trip.
On the trip. 10 games, 8 homers, 15 RBIs, and Seattle couldn't find a way to get him out. Salvador Perez, 8 homers, 15 RBIs on the road trip. He's playing like the league's MVP right now. Michael Taylor, home run the 7th, tied it at 2. Seager with a 2-run homer in the bottom of the 7th, 4-2. And then Salvi nearly tied it with the ball off the wall. That could have easily been a 2-run homer, just missed it. Brady Singer, a nice start. He's had a couple of good starts. That's promising. 6 innings, 3 hits, 2 runs, 3 walks, and 5 Ks. But the story here is Salvador Perez. Salvi's home run tied Mike Sweeney's franchise record for most consecutive games with a home run, which is 5 straight games. Perez's 38 homers are 2nd in the majors this season, behind only Shohei Ohtani, who has 41. They're already the 2nd most in a single season in Royals history, trailing only Jorge Soler at 48 just a couple years ago. He's tied Mike Moustakas' record at 38 in 2017. Remember when we kept talking about when are the Royals ever going to break Steve Alboni? Who's going to break Steve Alboni's single-season mark for home runs? The Royals have one of the lowest numbers at 36, and that dated back to 1985. Well, now, 3 times last 5 years, we've had Royals players tie or break that record. Actually, yeah. They've all broken
it. Yeah.
Moustakas, 38, Salvi now 38, and Soler, 48. With 32 games to go this season, Salvi has 38 homers, which are now the most among any American League catcher or player who has played at least 75% of his games as a catcher, passing Carlton Fisk's 37 in 1985. Also, Sunday shot for Salvi was his 26th as a catcher, the 12th to come as a DH. And here's some amazing numbers. In his last 162 games, here is Salvi's stats. And then we're not even counting defense where he's winning gold gloves. In his last 162 games, Salvador Perez is hitting .289, 47 home runs, 122 RBIs on a losing team.
Mm-hmm.
And this year, 38 homers, 94 RBIs, hitting .277. And, oh, yeah, he's catching almost every day. And he's playing gold club catcher. And the rotation's been better. And he's the guy that leads them behind the plate. And for a guy, all that wear and tear on your knees and your legs, trust me, it's not hard to squat for an inning behind the plate. For him, what he's doing, it is quite marvelous what he's doing. It's absolutely, just absolutely awesome what Salvador Perez is doing. And his manager, Mike Matheny, is a little bit in awe as well.
Just as dangerous of a hitter as you're going to see for a period of time here. One of the best runs I've ever seen. Every pitch, he's seeing the ball so well and executing on different pitches all over the zone. It's impressive.
And he's been clutch. That's 25 late inning RBIs. The Royals won 10 of the last 14, 7-3 on the road trip through 3 cities. They're off today. They host Cleveland coming up tomorrow. Salvador Perez is 2nd in the league in home runs, 2nd in the majors in home runs, tied with, I forgot if it was Vlad or not, but he has 38. Ohtani has 41. He has 94 RBIs. He's got a good batting average. He doesn't walk a lot. He's only walked 18 times, but Ohtani strikes out a lot, so does Salvi. He strikes out his share, I should say. But on top of that, everybody talking about Ohtani being able to pitch and hit. Salvi plays the most demanding position on the field, and that's catcher, and he hits. And he's doing this now, and we're to the dog days of the end of August and into September. Shouldn't Salvador Perez be at least in the top five of MVP voting for the AL MVP? Shouldn't he be in the top five?
Based on what he's done right now, yeah.
I agree.
So. Yeah.
He should be considered for MVP. And before you start going, well, the Royals aren't any good. They're a losing team, Wade. I mean, they're 59-71. You know what? That is true. That is true. So if you're going to punish a guy on a team that's not very good, then clearly you're against Shohei Ohtani being the MVP as well. Let's be consistent. Let's be consistent. The Angels are 64-67. They are a losing team. So are the Royals. All right? Vlad Guerrero Jr. would be my MVP pick. He's only 22. In a normal year, he'd win the MVP. And the Blue Jays are fourth in their division. Now, granted, they're in a tough division, 68-61. Mm-hmm. But they're fourth in their division. So let me get this straight. Some of the top MVP guys in the American League. Well, Salvi can't get it because the Royals aren't any good. Well, you have to be a winner to win MVP. Otani's team is three games under with a losing record. Vladimir Guerrero's team is in fourth place in a five-team division. And the Royals are fourth in a five-team division, and they're under 500. Is there somebody I'm missing here, MVP? We've got to pick them from a winning team. It seems like the main guys is number one's Otani, and number two is Vlad Guerrero Jr. And, I mean, that's not exactly sitting here. You want to bust chops about Salvi being considered. If those two are considered, absolutely Salvi should be considered.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, as you go back in history and, like, look at people who win the MVP, it's like it's not always somebody that ends up playing on a championship team or anything like that.
Right.
You know, baseball is a little bit different in that regard of it's not always somebody that's on those teams.
Right.
Just I mean, usually you probably are on a winning team, most likely.
Just to give you an idea, at the All-Star break, which was only 6 weeks ago, the favorite to win MVP in American League was Ohtani.
Yeah.
All right. Number two is Vlad Guerrero Jr. of Blue Jays. And there was two Red Sox players. And then and on this list, there's 20 players mentioned. Salvador Perez isn't one of them. This is at the All-Star break.
Yeah.
And he was having a good year up to that point. But now he's just red hot in August. He has 12 homers in the month of August. He's hitting home runs almost every single day. He's playing the most demanding position on the field, which is catcher. Pitching is a demanding thing because, you know, all the pressure's on you, but that's once every 5 days. I can make a very big argument that Salvador Perez, what he's doing in regards to the physical demand, is tougher than Ohtani. The physical demand.
Yeah.
Now, the mental part, I don't know. I mean, the mental part, you play outfield, you hit, and then all of a sudden you're pitching, and you got to be prepared to pitch and have a scouting report, and you got to be ready to hit. I'm not saying that's easy. I think the mental part might very well be on Ohtani's side.
Mm-hmm.
The physical part, I think, is on Perez's side as to which is more difficult physically. And some people may say, well, what do you mean? I mean, you know, Ohtani's got to, you know, he's got to throw all those pitches. Salvi's got to throw guys out. He's got to use his arm, too.
Yeah.
And he's calling every single pitch. He's squatting every time. Trust me, you think it's nothing? Go squat behind the home plate for an inning. For 10 minutes, just squat behind home plate. And then get up and tell me how your knees feel. Seriously.
Yeah.
You do that. Because what Salvi is doing, it has to be appreciated. And hopefully the national media is catching on. And this goes back to the All-Star game when they had the home run derby, and he's crushing homers, and all they're doing is talking to another guy.
Yeah.
He was getting no respect then either. And he needs to be, I mean, he's respected across the league. Everybody, all the players respect him. All the players know he's having an MVP-type year. It's about the national media, whether they wake up or not. Listen, I'm not saying Salvador Perez should be the MVP. I'm not saying that. I think Ohtani should still be the MVP. And Vlad Guerrero Jr. is having a great year. And if I had to vote right now, I'd probably go one would be Ohtani, two would be Vlad, and three would be Salvi. Now, I might be missing some guys that I need to do more homework on, but those are the guys that catch a lot of the attention, or at least the top two do. But all three of them are on either a losing team or a team in fourth place. Actually, all three of them are on teams in fourth place out of five teams. I didn't even notice that. Each one of those three guys are on fourth place teams in five-team divisions. So you knock Salvi, you knock Ohtani. Okay, well, then the Blue Jays are fourth in their division. So, you know, who are you going to get an MVP to? I don't know. But Salvi should be in the top five at the very least, in my opinion. Agreed?
I agree.
Do you think he should be considered as the actual MVP?
I mean, Vlad's hitting .312 right now. You know, like his average is up, his homers are up, his RBI are, you know, everything's kind of similar.
Yeah.
He's hitting better. His team is 7 games above .500, even though they're in fourth place. I think Vlad is probably ahead of Salvi right now. Otani's going to win it, I think. I don't even think we even need to talk about.
Unless he gets hurt right now.
Yeah. But I would put it in the same order that you did. Mm-hmm. Because I just, and whether I feel Otani is the MVP or not, I'm pretty sure he's going to win it, right?
Yeah, I agree.
And so just because nobody's done what he's done, like ever. And so I feel like he's going to win it. So I'd put it in the same order. But, yeah, I think he should be in the discussion. People should definitely be talking about Salvador Perez. I mean, you have 8 home runs and 15 RBI in 10 games. You've homered 5 games in a row. You're saying he's homering almost every day. Literally right now he is homering every day.
Oh, by the way, he's a Gold Glove catcher. So he does it both
absolutely.
Ways.
Yeah.
You know?
And you know, he'll probably get that again too. But
yeah.
I mean, he'll at least be a finalist. I don't know if he'll win it again.
Matt Olson's had a pretty good year for Oakland, so he's going to get some votes. Rafael Devers of the Red Sox, of course, East Coast, he'll get votes, especially if the Red Sox make the playoffs. But, yeah, I mean, Salvi's got to be in the top 5, without question, in my opinion. I don't think there's really a big debate over that. Shouldn't be a debate over that. But Richard Lovelady, he's had a pretty good season since he got called up. He had pain in his elbow on Saturday after he pitched Friday night, and that's a shame because he's been a good piece out of the bullpen, a left-hand pitcher. Worked so hard to get to the bigs. ERA at 2.35 his last 15 games. He may need Tommy John surgery, so that's not good. But good news, MJ Melendez went 4-for-4, 2 homers, 3 triple, 4 RBIs. Bobby Witt Jr., Nick Prado each hit their 28th homers of the year, and Jackson Cowher struck out 7 his last outing. So there's some good news from the farm at AAA Omaha. Little League World Series is in the books. We have a World Series champion.
This ball driven to center. It's playable. Farkas is there, and it ends in his glove. And the Taylor North Little Leaguers are World Series champions.
So there you have it. Michigan beats Ohio. Finally, Michigan beats Ohio in something. Congratulations. They were in the same region, which is pretty rare for that to happen. So Taylor, Michigan wins over Hamilton, Ohio, 5-2. No teams from overseas or the countries this year in the Little League World Series. So there's no America versus the USA versus the international or whatever.
Yeah.
Not going to have that. I'm sure that's due to COVID-19.
Yeah, it is.
Chiefs observations of Friday. They win 28-25 over the Vikings. Well, one of the key, you know, the fun stuff is you never get tired of it as a Chiefs fan is Mahomes hooking up with Hill for touchdowns.
Mahomes in the shotgun this time. Creed Humphrey ready to snap it on the far hash. Mahomes takes it, looks out the receiver, throwing long. The pass will be caught. Touchdown! Kansas City, 35-yard touchdown to the cheetah. Burning Rashad Breeland, the old chief.
Here's Andy Reid on Mahomes getting an extended look and more playing time on Friday.
I just think the more he plays them, the better, and I thought it was an important week this week for him to have a chance to get some reps in against who I think is one of the best defense coordinators in the National Football League. I mean, you know, Zim has been doing it a long time, and he's got experienced guys over there as coaches, and you know, they're going to be disciplined with what they do. So I thought it was good to get in and have him get some reps there.
Yeah, first-string offense. Mahomes out there 8-for-9, 117 yards, 2 touchdown drives. Jerick McKinnon looked good. I think he's going to make the team as a running back. You know, Derek Gore, he's been working hard. He had a long touchdown reception. It was a short pass on the screen. I don't think he's going to make the team. And that's what we lead to next is what about cutdown day? And by the way, John Betts at Kansas Pregame coming up here in just a moment to preview 8-man Division 1 and 2 high school football. The cutdown is 3 o'clock is the deadline tomorrow. Cutdown to the 53-man roster. And the Chiefs have some tough decisions. I hear people saying the Chiefs have tough decisions on the offensive line. I disagree. I'll explain that in a moment. They have tough decisions at wide receiver and tight end, and I would agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
I would agree with that. It seems like the biggest positions that they got to worry about in regards to figuring it out are on offense. And I hear some Chiefs fans complaining about how they can't keep everybody. That's a great sign. It's a fantastic sign that the Chiefs can't keep everybody. You know why? Because that means how deep and talented this team is. Like, their defensive line's another position where there's going to be an odd guy out. Tim Ward might be the odd guy out, and he's had a decent preseason.
Mm-hmm.
So that's good to have depth in numbers to where you're so deep that some of the team's going to grab a guy, and that might be a good player for them. I mean, the Darius Fountain kid, wide receiver, he's had a really good preseason. I don't think he's going to make this team, but he's had an outstanding preseason. Mm-hmm. Joey Fortson's done a nice job at tight end. He very well could make this team. Jerick McKinnon's had a nice preseason. I think he'll make the team as that last running back, unless they have Darwin Thompson as an extra running back on special teams. You really look at it. Offensive line, here's why I don't believe it's a big deal. First of all, Tardif's hurt. You can put him on IR, and you can get him back. Mm-hmm. And Austin Blythe had hernia surgery. He can get him back. And those are backups right now anyway.
Yeah.
And then Kyle Long's on the pup list, so that don't even count on your roster right now. So they've got three linemen out of those 9 or 10 they started with that are hurt or not available anyway. Mm-hmm. Now, that they're eventually going to have to make decisions, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But right now on cutdown day, it's going to be, I think, pretty clear as to who they're going to keep. It's going to be pretty much the guys that have been playing that are those top guys. I mean, Wiley's going to make the team, I'd imagine. Rimmer's going to make the team. Allegretti's going to make the team. They're going to have 9 linemen. And then they're going to have to figure out how to designate Tardif and Long and Austin Blythe. So they'll be fine there. I don't think there's, like, major decisions yet. Now, once Tardif is ready or Blythe is ready or Kyle Long's ready, yeah, okay, now you're going to have to make some decisions on what you're going to do offensive line. But that's down the road. You can kick the can down the road on that. Defensive line, like I said, Damone Harris, Tim Ward, I think one of those guys is the odd man out. Wide receiver, I think Fountain unfortunately is not going to make this team. I think Cornell Powell isn't going to make this team, a 5th-round draft pick. Tight end, you've got Kelsey, you got Bell, you've got the rookie Gray out of Duke, who they like, but he hasn't had a great preseason. And then you got Fortson, who's done a nice job. Fortson really did – I tell you, that touchdown pass to Gore, Fortson did a great job running the field and blocking. Yeah. It really was impressive.
They had everybody downfield.
Yeah, they did.
Doing a really good job on that play.
And that's one thing that Andy Reid, a few years ago, the Chiefs had at least a lot of success with sometimes 3 tight end sets and 2 were blockers. And, you know, Fortson can block. Blake Bell's okay blocker. Gray is not really a blocker. Kelsey's a decent blocker. So there is a scenario, and Adam Teicher says that he covers the Chiefs on a regular basis. He says he thinks the Chiefs are going to keep 4 tight ends. He thinks they're going to keep 4. Mm-hmm. And he thinks that means Darwin Thompson might be – you're going to have to lose him as a roster spot. I could see that. Wide receiver, you know, DeMarcus Robinson drives me nuts. And there might be a guy out there the Chiefs might go grab, and they might cut loose at DeMarcus Robinson, possibly, which I'm okay with.
Yeah.
There might be some other places where the Chiefs might pick up somebody. Corner, I think they're fine. They got, you know, Mike Hughes is a 3rd corner now. Looks great behind Snead and Ward. I don't think you're going to miss Breland very much. And you got Fenton's going to be on this team. And, of course, I like the Andre Baker. He's going to make this team. Safety, you're pretty set. You got Thornhill. You got Sorensen. You got Matthew. Watts will be a special teams player. Linebacker, you got Gay. You got Bolton. You got Neiman. You got Hitchens. I mean, they're okay at linebacker. They're not great, but they're okay in regards to figuring out who's going to make the team. So when you look at it, it really, to me, the toughest 2 spots to decide who's going to make this team is going to be tight end, and it's going to be wide receiver. But I think, for the most part, we have it figured out, for the most part, unless the Fountain Kid makes this team. Yeah. For some people think Fortson won't make the team, which, okay, if that happens, then maybe you keep Darwin Thompson, because the Chiefs have had injuries at running back. They did last year. And perhaps you keep Thompson as insurance, and he plays special teams. He's an okay special teams player.
Yeah.
That might be. I mean, Derek Gore had a decent camp. Maybe Gore makes a team and not Thompson. I don't know. But those are the spots that I think are going to be difficult for the Chiefs to decide on. And also keep in mind that some of these guys are having really good preseasons that are backups or playing against backups. Do keep that in mind.
Yeah. I saw a story the other day that somebody was coming out with hot takes or whatever, who's going to make the roster, and somebody was like, Dorrie Fountain's going to make it and DeMarcus Robinson isn't. And I'm like, I'll believe that I see it.
No,
you know, I mean, no. I want to say that. I would like to see that, Fountain make it and Robinson not. But you're not booting a guy that's been in this system for that long and keeping Fountain. I just don't see it happening.
And Robinson's
now,
playing against ones and
maybe
twos.
So.
Or Fountain's playing against twos and threes.
Yeah.
That's something else that fans
would I like to see that happen? I probably would, but I don't see it happening. I'm not buying that
until I
actually see it. I'm not buying DeMarcus Robinson not making the team in any formal way.
Right.
Because of what I just said. I mean, he's been in the system, and I know that Dave Tobe said some things about him, like he frustrates and makes him mad and gets on his nerves and everything like that. But that's a special teams coordinator, and Robinson knows this system. And it's hard to boot a guy out like that, even though he does frustrate you.
Yeah. Very frustrating at times. But, yes, I agree. He'll make the team. And unless they trade and get a guy that's, you know, significantly better.
Yeah,
and then
somewhere
maybe
that's not going to make their team, they feel is better than Robinson, that could happen.
I still think Robinson's on the team probably no matter what happens, at least initially. So cut down 3 o'clock tomorrow, and we'll see if there's any surprises. U.S. Open tennis begins today in New York without the Williams sisters. Venus and Serena both out due to injuries. Nadal's out. Federer's out with knee surgery. So really, the guy you're watching is Novak Djokovic, and that's about probably it for
me. That's the reason to watch this tournament, to see if he can get his fourth of the year and take over the all-time record.
It'd be 21 would be the way he's shooting for it. It'd be all-time record tie with Nadal and Federer with 20 majors.
State, regional, and national sports talk on your schedule. The Sports Ticket Podcast. Subscribe via Apple, Google, and TuneIn Podcasts or sunflowerstateradio.com.